And in particular, a big selling point to the NSF is that this kind of work can help LIGO extract the most science possible, and possibly to just help detect in general. So this involves possibly helping with templates, involve search strategies, facilitate detecting counterparts, that kind of thing. And you know, perhaps the biggest thing of all is to find surprises. Okay, so Okay, so what kind of processes am I talking about? I'm not going to go into detail about any of this, but let me just give a short little dictionary here. Hopefully you guys have some familiarity with some of this stuff. So short gamma ray bursts. These are hugely energetic events, at least in the electromagnetic spectrum. They're very short, and we suspect that compact object mergers are powering them. They're jets that occur in all different contexts that we'd like to understand better. There are these kilonova that are generally isotropic, that can either be in infrared or optical. They're transients, usually associated with GRBs. They're thought to give rise to these heavy elements via this radio, well, the kilonova get produced by the radioactive decay of these heavy elements arising from the binary neutron star mergers. There, in the past few years, there have been these fast radio bursts, these radio transients that appear to be extragalactic, and people don't really know very much about them. Very recently, at least one of them appears to be repeating. There are all sorts of papers giving all sorts of explanations, but for the most part, it's pretty open what's producing these. And then neutron stars in general occur in all different contexts, and that's one of the things that I model. Okay, so what I want to talk about today is these four different papers that I've worked on recently. The last one, the charged black hole binaries, that's work in progress. I've been talking about it with people during the coffee breaks and stuff, and no one's laughed at me so far, but we'll see what you guys think about them. And some of the talks have given me some ideas. So that's kind of a fun project. So I look forward to talking about it with you. Okay, so let's start with the binary neutron star mergers. And I should say that all of this, I'm not going to talk much about the numerics, but all of this is three-dimensional. So 3+1, pretty heavy-duty numerical work. But I'll try and spare you from some of that. So the main thrust of my work is this binary neutron star mergers. And so this is kind of a slide that talks about kind of a lot that's gone into it. So what we can do with this involves realistic equations of state. So by that, we've got finite temperature. It spans a huge range of densities that go past nuclear densities. It's a regime of matter that people don't really know about. So the hope is that by looking at binary neutron star mergers, we can extract this equation of state, this regime of matter that we can't study on Earth. I mean, in particular, a couple years ago, I was at the Institute of Nuclear Theory at the University of Washington, and these people want to know what we can get from the astrophysics because they can't study it on the Earth. Anyway, so we can model this. We've added a scheme to incorporate neutrinos. We do it in a very simple scheme. It's called a leakage scheme using this open source leakage code from stellarcollapse.org. We've got to keep track of optical depth. I won't bore you with the details about this leakage scheme, but the merger happens on scales of milliseconds, so we don't have to keep track of too much. But we've put that in this code. This code is a big code. And so our first paper on this, we studied equal mass case, and we looked at a few different equations of state. I'll talk a little bit about that. But the idea is basically what we're looking for is what role does the equation of state play that we can then use these observations to extract that information. And so I'll say some more here. And in particular, we're one of the few groups that has all this and can look at magnetization. I'm not going to talk anything more about magnetization, but we did study it before, and we found that if you have a high level of magnetization in the stars, it can increase the amount of ejecta. And the ejecta is basically, so these stars merge together and they kick out some material. And that material basically affects a few different things, but in particular, it can affect whether you get a kilonova, whether you get this IR transient afterwards. Okay, so in terms of the equation of state, so what we did was we picked three. And the three that we picked are listed here. And in particular, what we wanted to do was span a range of stiffnesses. And so what I show here are the masses you get for neutron stars, not the binaries, but just individual neutron stars versus the radius. And if you go out and look at neutron stars, the most massive neutron star that anyone's ever seen is two solar masses here. And so that's that blue line there, right? And so we only wanted to consider equations of state that gave us one of these neutron stars. And so you see every one of these gives us a two solar mass neutron star. And the other thing that you'll notice is that the radius that gives you that two solar mass is very different, right? So here it's about 11 and a half, and here it's about 15 kilometers. So that's what I'm talking about. So we picked three basically extreme in terms of how big that neutron star is. But when we go to decide what kind of binary we're going to evolve, we pick a more typical binary. So a typical binary has a total mass of about 2.7 solar masses. In particular, each one is about 1.35 solar masses. So we pick two stars for the equal mass case of this mass. But the work I'll talk about is the unequal mass case. But for the unequal mass, we stuck to that 2.7 solar mass for the total mass. Okay, so here's just a table. I don't expect you to look at that, but in case anyone asked me, I wanted to have it so I could take a look. Okay, so we can produce the gravitational waves, right? So here I show you the gravitational waves. These are for the three different EOS. And you can see the gravitational waveforms as you change the mass ratio. So this mass ratio is Q. Q equals 1 is the symmetric case. So within any equation of state, you change the mass ratio and you get a very different gravitational wave signature, which is great, right? So as soon as LIGO does something really great like observe neutron stars, now I don't mean to knock LIGO, but you know, when are they going to see these neutron stars? I don't know. As soon as they do, you'd think, oh great, we're going to be able to tell lots of information. The problem is in this next plot. So you take these waveforms and you Fourier decompose them and you plot them versus frequency, the wave strain. So you convert this psi 4 to a wave strain and you plot them. So we just have a few on here and you plot them here. And then here, this is the noise curve. So basically to the upper left of these two noise curves is what LIGO can see. And if we ignore this noise curve for a second, so if we just look to the left of this, I guess it's magenta, you see all the noise curves are, all the signal that LIGO can see is basically the same. So in particular, what the differences you're seeing are at high frequency with respect to LIGO. So the problem is that LIGO can't see these differences, which is not good. Now let me mention the green curve. The green curve is if you do some kind of tuning. So if you do some kind of tuning, then there's a little bit of hope that maybe you can start to differentiate. So if you tune the detector basically for neutron stars, right? So if LIGO sees lots and lots of stuff and it starts to get bored and then says, hey, you know, let's pay a lot more attention to neutron stars and go for some high frequency stuff, then maybe they can get to this noise curve. I mean, I'm no expert on this, and I guess Kip's not here. But then maybe there's some hope that they could resolve some of this. So not all hope is lost yet, because the idea is that what we can do is now combine this information with other bands. So there's still EM information, and there's still the neutrino bands. Okay, so what I'll talk about next is what information can we get from that? In particular, let me just I guess I still have a couple more things to say about gravitational waves. So in particular, if you look at the post-merger, after these neutron stars come together, you get a remnant. And the remnant takes a little while to settle down. And in particular, it's still emitting gravitational waves. And you can Fourier decompose that signal. And what you get is a peak frequency that's basically characterizes basically like a bar mode as it settles down. And if you look at that peak frequency versus something that basically just depends on the parameters of the EOS, this contact frequency you can calculate based on the compactness of the EOS. Then what you can do is we've figured out this fit, and we plot a number of the binaries that we looked at along with a couple from the Caltech Cornell group. And so the hope is that if you could measure this, there may be a way to basically target these frequencies. Okay, so now let me talk about the EM stuff. So I mentioned this kilonova. So this kilonova is a radio emission long after the merger. So let's say LIGO sees a merger, and we go after this EM signal after the merger, and we see a kilonova. And so we start looking at the properties of this kilonova, and from those properties, we can tell something about the electron fraction. So the electron fraction is basically a property of how neutron-rich or electron-poor the ejecta is. And so because we're using a realistic equation of state, we have some idea of the composition of the ejecta. And so what I'm plotting over here is basically a relative property of the ejecta. This is the ejecta, this is the bound. So the bound stuff, the stuff in the remnant that's bound to the remnant, it just doesn't really matter what equation of state or mass ratio you have. But as you change the mass ratio, you very much change the properties of the ejecta. And in particular, you're much more likely to get a kilonova signal for either a soft equation of state or a low mass ratio. And so if you combine the LIGO signal, the LIGO information about the mass ratio, with any kilonova information that you get from the EM, then it's possible that you can extract some information about the EOS. Okay, so also looking at the EM signal, what you can do is you can look at the time scales of things. So there are at least two possible EM signals that you can look at. One is this EM signal, the kilonova that I was talking about. So there's a model for the various time scales involved with that, where you can model basically how long it takes for the rise time to get to the peak here. And so what we've done is we've estimated these using this model. And then there's another one. So the ejecta is going to get flung out. It's unbound material. And it's going to hit the interstellar medium and cause some radio transient. And so that has a different model here that we also model here. Right, so this is yet another way to try and understand a binary. And keep in mind that this is going to take, you know, so here the time scale is basically days, and here it's some fraction of a year, or I guess up to more than a year. So if LIGO sees an event, we've got some time to look for this information. Okay, so that was in the EM band. So if it's close enough, then it's possible we'll get some information from the neutrino signal. I mentioned we use a leakage scheme to keep track of this information. And so here we do a number of things with the neutrinos, but here what we do is we plot just the total luminosity in ergs per second of the neutrinos. And you see, if you look at the symmetric case, so where it's equal mass, Q equals one, you see this oscillating signal for all the EOS. So for the symmetric case, the stars come together and merge. And when they merge, they basically kind of oscillate as they try and sort of reach spherical symmetry. And so basically in that decompression stage, you basically let out a lot of neutrinos. Whereas in the asymmetric case, you get this tidal disruption, and it appears you get a more kind of a smoother luminosity in the neutrinos. So that's another way you can sort of extract the mass ratio from that. So for only one, did we run three different mass ratios? Yeah. Yeah, these runs are pretty intensive. You know, many a couple months to run. Okay, and so we estimate, you know, some average energies, and basically, so for 10 kiloparsecs, which is not very far at all, for a certain kind of detector, you can estimate basically how many events you expect to see. And again, so for this is our softest equation of state, you expect to see a fair number of detections, whereas for a hard equation of state, so this is for the biggest stars. The collision is not very violent because the stars come together. It's sort of like two basketballs coming together. They kind of hit together and kind of merge. Whereas if you have really small stars, they come together and they have more space. They get together. It's a more violent collision because they reach further down into the gravitational well, and it releases more energy. At 10 kpc, it's pretty high, right? I mean, I don't know about probability, but this is like how many events per millisecond. Oh, yeah, well, I don't know that, yeah. Yeah. Okay, so let me move past here. Okay, so related to this, basically with these same simulations, what we also did was we looked at what's called this M equal one spiral arm instability. And so when these mergers happens, in general, what you get is what's called this bar mode instability. So this is an M equal two. And so when I'm talking about M equal two, I'm talking about in the density. And so if you look in the azimuthal direction, what you get is an M equal two mode. And so here, what you're looking at in the horizontal is the azimuthal direction. And so if you've got e to the I two phi, then it looks something like that. Whereas for an M equal one, as you go around here, if M equals one, e to the I phi, it would look something like that. And so the difference here is that what we're looking at is something like 2 milliseconds after merger, you've got M equal two mode. Whereas if you wait till about 16 milliseconds after merger, now what you've seen is a development of a M equal one mode. And so this was seen in recent simulations by Will East and Franz and a few other people, and then also seen in some more recent work by Radice and Bernuzzi and on. So what we did, we took a look at our simulations and we found similar stuff. So we did some studies of this. And so what I was talking about here was with respect to density. But the same thing kind of carries over into the gravitational wave spectrum. And so here what we're doing is we're looking in the gravitational wave. So the L equal two, M equal one, or M equal two, we're plotting them on the same curve here. In general, what you see is that the L equal two, M equal two mode is strong versus the L equal two, M equal one is in general much weaker than that. And you see that it develops from merger here. And so what we did, we studied it for different mass ratios. This is all for the same equation of state. I think I've got on a future slide, I've got it for different equations of state. And what you find, so for the symmetric case, you've got to break that symmetry. So the M equal one breaks that symmetry. And so in the symmetric case, it takes a little bit of time for that symmetry to get broken by turbulence and basically development of these vortices. And so here what you're looking at is this decomposition into these azimuthal modes in terms of the density. And so it's a little hard to see on here, but the M equal one mode is in black. And it gets, it grows within the span of a few milliseconds here, and then it basically saturates. Whereas the M equal two mode decays here. In contrast, for the more extreme mass ratio 0.76, the M equal one mode grows more quickly, and it basically dominates more quickly as well. Okay, so here we've got different equations of state, and you can see for the soft equation of state, the M equal one mode is stronger. So for the softer equation of state, the M equal one mode is going to be stronger for the softer equation of state. This one, the soft equation of state collapses relatively soon, and so that's why that one stops. Okay, but so one thing we did was to look at the signal-to-noise ratio, rho, and what we did when we did this was we just assumed a constant amplitude of something like 10 to the minus 4 for the psi 4, the signal, and a constant frequency, 1.3 kilohertz. So this is constant over a time scale of 10 milliseconds. So the issue is how long does this thing last? So this is relatively conservative. If I go back to this here, so here we're assuming 10 milliseconds here. The issue of how long it survives is a somewhat subtle one because there are a lot of effects that can go into kind of how long it lasts. I mean, in particular, you know, if the thing collapses, it's not going to last that long. But there are magnetic effects that we hadn't turned on here. There are neutrino effects. I'd mentioned we can keep track of neutrinos, but that we were using a leakage scheme. And a leakage scheme kind of depends on the fact that our timescales are short. So if you want to go to 100 milliseconds, you really need to do something more sophisticated with the neutrinos. But so we do all that, and we get a signal-to-noise ratio of 0.6. So I don't know how familiar you are with signal-to-noise ratios. So the first LIGO detection, the signal-to-noise ratio, I think, was something like 24, which was phenomenal. The most recent one was, 12, something like that. So 0.6 is a little bit discouraging. The things that the M equal 1 mode has going for it is that, in general, it lasts longer than the M equal 2. It's at a lower frequency. A lower frequency in general is going to be, you know, more sensitive on the LIGO noise curve. And one thing that we point out is that if LIGO does detect these neutron stars, in general it's going to be detecting the M equal 2 mode. And so if it can detect that, then you can basically just take half that frequency, and then you can go into the data and target the M equal 1 mode. You pretty much know precisely what frequency to look for. And so even if you have a low SNR, you can go in and target it. And so then you have this sort of other avenue to go in, and basically the same EOS information is going to be encoded in that same signal there. And so it's another kind of avenue to try and extract this EOS information in there. Okay. So I think I'm doing okay on time. So then I've got these two other projects. These are separate from the BNS stuff. and I think they're pretty interesting. And in particular, they deal a little bit more with cosmology. And so maybe some of you might be more interested in this. And so the idea with this project is that perhaps we can constrain gravity using neutron stars. And in particular, so this involves a particular scalar tensor theory of gravity, but it's not any kind of endorsement of this particular theory. It just happens to be one that we can use to do it. And so it depends on this. So there's a paper by Mendez just, I guess it's a couple years ago now, that noticed this instability for very compact neutron stars. I mean, we think of neutron stars as compact, but if they're very compact, you can get the trace of the stress energy tensor in the center to be positive in the center for realistic equations of state. And if you do so, you can get this instability for the scalar field. So yeah, I guess I kind of skipped over this, but so this is a scalar tensor theory, so one of these DEF models, where you have a scalar tensor, a scalar field coupled to a metric for the theory of gravity. And in particular, we're looking in this positive beta region. So Nico was talking about these constraints on scalar tensor theories and basically said that the negative beta region is pretty well constrained. But in the positive region, things are somewhat unconstrained. And so this was an interesting paper, but one thing kind of left open was, what's the end state of this instability? Does it saturate? Do you get collapse? What happens? And so we had a code that we could model this, and that's precisely what we did. So let me just mention a little bit about the instability. So here, what you're looking at here, these are just basically the phase space of neutron stars. So if you look at the top here, so these are just the normalized masses versus compaction M over R. And this is for different gammas, for the gamma law polytropes, basically. So if you look for a small gamma, this is the highest gamma you can reach. And so in general, you expect the stars to the left of this box to be stable, and the stars to the right of the box to be unstable. And this the circle is where you get the chain, where the trace of the stress energy at the center to be zero. So in this region, the trace of the stress energy tensor becomes positive, but these solutions are unstable anyway. And so it's not really relevant that you'll get the instability. But if you come over here now, I guess it would be in this region. But if you come up to a gamma of, let's say gamma is 3, in this region, these stars should be stable in general, except for the fact that now this circle has moved over here. And so these solutions should now be unstable to this instability, even though they would otherwise be stable. And so it's these kinds of stars that we're going to evolve. And then similarly, down here, what we have, these are rotating solutions, right? So the black is basically the same as this, but then we can go to rotating solutions. And so in general, to the left of these boxes would be stable solutions, except for the fact that these solutions have this trace of the stress energy tensor at the center being positive. And so now we expect to find this instability. And so these are the solutions that we're going to evolve. And so here's the dynamics, right? So here we're plotting these central values. And if we take stars with small, and so this only occurs in this, if beta, the coupling is positive. So if beta is zero, we recover GR. So if beta is zero, just look at the blue, then you don't see anything. These are just stable stars. Nothing happens. And if you go to large beta, this, I don't know, cyan, you get this instability. Okay, so the density grows, this is the scalar field, the central value of the scalar field, it gets large. And as you can tune this beta, and you basically find a critical value of beta around 100 and between 115 and 131. Okay, and so somewhere between those two values of beta, this instability turns on. And so we want to find out kind of what's going on with this instability. And so I really like this plot because here what we're doing is looking at precisely what's going on. So here we're plotting the scalar field versus R as a function of time, right? So we start with the scalar field, just some small value. And what happens is that the scalar field grows and it oscillates about this black curve. And this black curve is not part of the dynamics. This black curve is an equilibrium solution. And so what you see, if I go back to the, what you see is that you see that you can form a black hole or you can oscillate about one of these equilibrium solutions. So you basically get two different behaviors, and those two different behaviors we can plot on a phase-based diagram like this. So here, this is just mass versus central density. This is kind of a common plot in this kind of thing. And the black curve are the GR solutions. And so if you go to the maximum mass, you expect these solutions to be unstable and these to be stable. And then this is kind of the same curve as you increase beta. So as you increase beta, this curve just kind of gets pulled down. And so as you increase beta and then you put the dynamics on here, your solution basically wants to find the stable solutions. But if you start above where there is no stable solution, it can't stop at the unstable thing, and so it just gets sent off to the black hole solution. Whereas a solution down here will just oscillate about a stable solution. So it'll either oscillate about a stable solution or it'll just get sent off to black hole formation. And so, So in particular, so we were able to basically study what happens to the solution. So you either find, you either oscillate around the stable solution or you get sent off to black hole formation. We were also able to say that this is pretty robust. It happens for rotating solutions. So remember, we were doing this in three dimensions. And so what we can do is we can say that this represents something of a bound, right? So if you look at the most massive star, I mentioned this earlier, the most massive star is two solar masses. But if you look at the compactness, it's about 0.28, which is basically in the neighborhood of where this instability turns on, meaning that the trace of the stress energy tensor with what we know about equations of state is around where this instability turns on. So maybe that star is telling us that, you know, gravity is described by a scalar tensor, and we have this beta in this regime. I mean, I'm stretching a little bit, but the idea is that maybe we're entering a regime where we're getting to know something about what this beta could be. It's definitely a stretch, but the idea is that with more information, maybe we can actually play this game a little bit. And I should mention that there was a paper more recently here, so Mendez and Nestor have extended this work. So in spherical symmetry, they've done, they basically repeated our work and confirmed it. But not only that, they've extended it to different couplings. And they found that not only do you see what we see, but you can also get this dynamic scalarization. So the picture is actually a little bit more complicated. And so it'll be interesting to see what the implications of that are. Okay. So the last thing I want to talk about is charged black hole binaries. So this is in the context of this Fermi GBM detection. So with the LIGO, the most recent one, I didn't get a chance to ask Kip if there were any triggers, if triggers went out to the electromagnetic detectors or anything like that. But with the original LIGO detection, there was a claimed coincident detection, a counterpart, by the Fermi GBM satellite and detector. And what they found was a weak GRB. It was 0.4 seconds after the gravitational wave peak. It lasted for 1 second. It was something like 10 to the 49 ergs per second. So there was a paper, and they claimed that it was coincident. It came from this LIGO the LIGO detection. Now, there's some controversy because Agile and Integral, these two other detectors, they didn't see it. LIGO didn't sign the paper. It's not clear exactly whether it was coincident. So, we can argue. I'm no expert, so I'm not going to argue. We can, pick one way or the other, but people that know me know that I'm an optimist. So I'm going to choose to say that, maybe this is coincident. It's certainly a lot more exciting to think that it is. And if it is, then we've got to figure out why two black holes that have a pretty clean signal, a gravitational wave signal, are somehow producing a pretty large electromagnetic signal. And so there are lots of possibilities. I didn't dedicate a slide to it, but a number of papers have come out. I don't think any of them are terribly convincing by themselves. But there's one by Zhang who says that charged black holes could be producing it. And so his paper basically says that all you need is a charge to mass ratio of something like 10 to the minus 4. And 10 to the minus 4 is a small number, right? 10 to the minus 4 by itself is a small number. I mean, forget for a second that that's something like 10 to the 16 coulombs. 10 to the minus 4 is small. How black holes are going to have that charge? Well, I think I've got a slide on that. So, there are some possibilities for how black holes can be charged, and we've got a list of some of this. I don't know how convincing that is. So when I started this, I had a couple different motivations, and I'll talk about them in a second. One of which was basically to bound things, basically to say, okay, yeah, so it's not terribly believable that these black holes are going to be charged, but at least we can use it to make a bound. And this is the first LIGO detection. It's the first possible LIGO counterpart, and there's going to be a lot more, and so things can only get better. But there are other reasons to think about things. So if you have two black holes that are charged, and everything is clean outside, meaning that there's nothing outside these black holes, then what you can also say is that the black holes are monopoles. They're magnetic monopoles. It should be the same because, you know, in the absence of charges, there's the duality, you know, the electric and magnetic fields, you can just switch them. And so then you can say, well, the black holes are just magnetic monopoles. And then it's not too hard to find a paper that'll say that that these are primordial black holes, and Yassine's mentioned that these might be dark matter primordial black holes. And then the story grows a little bit richer, and it sounds more interesting. And I'm no expert. I can't defend most of this stuff. But then this kind of ties into some work we had done with black holes before, where so a black hole can't support its own magnetic field. And we had done some work with black holes inside an external magnetic field, an external magnetic field sourced by a circumbinary disk, and we found some interesting behavior with collimated, basically jets. And, you know, I was, even from way back then, I was always interested, well, you know, if we put a monopole field on there, and the only reason to put a monopole field on there is that a black hole can support a monopole field. You know, just what kind of dynamics would you get from just sort of a purely mathematical kind of idea? And so so the fact that there's some tie into some actual observation here, you know, I sort of jumped at the chance, you know, even if it's just mathematical. So, you know, you may kind of laugh at this, but I think it's kind of interesting. Yeah. Well, yeah, that's the idea. There is, do I have one? Yeah, I wouldn't expect, yeah. Yeah, there's a book by Punsley. He talks about, basically, if you have a spinning black hole that's charged, and you have basically like a ring of charges that's spinning as well, you can basically have the centrifugal force balance the electromagnetic, the Coulomb attraction. And he claims that basically that can survive for some amount of time. Well, I think the plasma would then be centrifugally, you know, expelled. Yeah, yeah. Certainly, yeah. I mean, it's tough. Yeah, if it's a significant charge, yeah, it's hard to see that it would survive very long. Yeah. Okay. So we looked at this, and here we plot the luminosity. And so, you know, you see the gravitational wave, its luminosity is much bigger than the electromagnetic. And I should say we looked at positive-positive. Everything is equal charge and equal mass. Except equal charge, except where there's zero charge, so we've got positive, negative, and positive, positive. One interesting thing is that when you have positive, positive, it's basically purely quadrupolar, and so it looks just like the gravitational wave luminosity. So here, if you rescale by 25 squared, it basically sits right on top. The positive zero case is basically a superposition of these two cases and sits right on top of the positive negative case. And then if you look at the, so this is the electromagnetic modes, and you see that same thing if you look in the dipolar and the quadrupolar modes here. Okay, so let me just kind of, this is my last slide, let me just finish up here. So we did all this, and we agree with Zhang's estimates, basically. So I mentioned this 10 to the minus 4. So 10 to the minus 4 will get you that 10 to the 49 ergs per second. I mentioned FRBs at the beginning. FRBs are a lot less energetic, so it's not too hard to get the FRBs. If you merge two black holes, you're obviously not going to repeat an FRB, but it's not clear that all FRBs are repeating. The one interesting thing I want to mention is that if you have two charged black holes, there's such a thing as this force-free environment. So I mentioned we did with these black holes this force-free environment. So the force-free assumes you have this tenuous plasma, And it assumes that the magnetic forces dominate over the electric forces. There's a bit more to it than that. But if you have charged black holes, you can't have force free. But once we turn on magnetic monopoles instead of electric monopoles, then we can turn on our force free scheme. And we're just now processing this. But when you do that, things become nonlinear, right? So in electro vacuum, the electromagnetic part is linear. But once we turn on the force free, then you get this nonlinearity stuff. And the luminosity is much more significant once we do that. And so it's possible that this with the monopolar field, that the amount of radiation is significantly more than if you just have two charged black holes. So we're anxious to kind of see what we get with that situation. I think things are going to be interesting there. And I'm anxious to kind of explore what some of the cosmologists think. You know, I mentioned some of these papers that I put over here in terms of the cosmology and stuff like that. But I think it's kind of an interesting problem. And I'll leave it at that. Thanks.
Questions?
So it seems to me the main problem is not the luminosity, but to get the right frequency, because I'm guessing Fermi, it's in either between MeV or GeV frequency. I don't quite remember the frequency. But
It's hard X-ray. Yeah, well, yeah, so this is a pointing flux. Yeah, so I do the usual where I
right, but I mean, the emission is at the frequency is the same as, I guess, hertz or, I guess, kilohertz frequency. That would be the same. That's, we would have same frequency that LIGO sees things. So that would, so you have to convert the pointing flux into.
Well, the X-rays. Usual thing is to say that that pointing flux is going to get reprocessed by the plasma and everything, and that's a very hard problem. So I kind of wipe my hands of that.
Okay, I see.
Yeah.
I mean, we heard earlier in the week constraints on cosmological magnetic fields, so. If you've got monopoles that have a magnetic charge that's 1/10,000th of the rest energy, then probably that's a, if there are more than a few of them, that's probably a pretty big magnetic field. I mean, even with the 1/r², you can get pretty far if it's that big.
Yeah, so let me say two things. One, I think with the force free, I think we'll be able to lower it significantly. Two, this paper by Vakasbadi suggests that the primordial monopoles short circuit the magnetic field, so that I think it may sort of go in the opposite direction in terms of the constraints, but I'm not sure about that.
Any other questions? All right, let's thank Steve one more time.